7, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Hello, Todd. Have a happy new year.
And a happy new year to you, too. We are doing this show on January 8th, 2026, our first recorded show of the new year. Certainly not our last.
Hopefully.
Now, hopefully. Before we talk about the serious matters of the day, let's talk about the chilling matters in your own life. It's cold in Boston.
It is very cold in Boston. I mean, the 8 o'clock in the morning yesterday was 10 degrees. I went out to go to the store, and it was definitely chilly. And I didn't check the temperature before I went out, so I just sort of dressed away, you know, one jacket and a shirt, and walked out the door and got a surprise.
Well, you know, having lived in Austin myself for a number of years, including at the MIT campus right next to the Charles River, which is adjacent to downtown Boston, I heard that the river froze over, which is a rare event. I think it froze over twice in the 16 years I lived there.
Yeah, when I was a kid, it used to freeze all the time. We used to ice skate on the river, I mean, year after year after year. And then and later in life, it just didn't freeze over. You know, and we've had a lot of students go through the ice, taking a shortcut across the Cambridge side to the Boston side, or vice versa, not to walk all the way around for the bridges, which are separated by a fair distance.
Now, having been a student there and having had the urge to take a shortcut, I would have never walked across the ice, because even when I saw people skating on the ice, it's like, that looks good from above on the bridge where I don't have a chance of falling through. So that's a risk I didn't want to take.
Yeah. And well, of course, the edges towards the land seem to freeze earlier than the middle. And that has probably something to do with the flow of water underneath it or something. Because everybody, the ice was always out in the middle.
Right. And then, of course, you have a bunch of undergraduates at Boston University, MIT, and Harvard, which are right adjacent to the river. And a few of them might have, I don't know, liquid courage, saying to themselves, hey, let's do something fun. Let's walk out on the ice. But that's not the kind of risk we take in aviation. And in fact, we're going to talk about something here today, which is going back a few years, 2002, where, make a long story short, ultimately, there's some unknown aspects to this accident. And before I get into that accident and about those heavy matters, let's talk about something that makes us happy. People who become members of the channel. We love members. We love them so much. We give them special opportunities like early access to our shows and other benefits to be determined later. So please, if you are interested in what we're doing, would like to support us, become members of the channel. And while we're at it, let's invite everyone, members and non-members, to send us questions. FlightSafetyDetectives@gmail.com. If you have a question or a comment, you can send it direct to us by email, or leave a question or a comment underneath any one of our videos. And for you folks out there who want to support us even more because you have a product or service that you'd like to promote, contact us at fsdsponsors@gmail.com, and we'll sit down with you, and we'll make sure that your product or service lands well with our audience.
Well, Todd, on the line, on the vein of the write-ins of emails, I answered a few of them earlier today, and we're looking at responding to several that we've received with questions around TWA 800, net accident investigation. And Todd and I have started to explore a way to go through the entire accident. I was involved with that very, very actively. So I have a lot to talk about on that accident and a lot of the pieces. And that is a very unique accident because of the amount of data that was gathered in the course of the investigation. And if you cherry pick certain sections of that data, you can change the probable cause any way you want. And but you have to take it, the report, in its entirety. And let me tell you, that was a chore for the board members to take that report in its entirety, because it, I think it has almost 1 million words in the report. And it was just a lot of technical details, a lot of meetings, a lot of explaining, between the subject matter experts and the board members and outside people as well. The people that did the work for us, we contracted out a lot I'll call them experiments to do to justify the positions that the board was taking. So it was very, very detailed, very, very. I don't think there's another one as detailed as that one. And
And
we'll
again,
walk through it.
you're not kidding about 1 million words, because we looked at the report, which is about 350 pages. There was an appendix to the report. I'm not sure how many hundreds of pages that were, but there were literally hundreds of documents in the public docket, excuse me. There were literally hundreds of documents in the public docket. And just for fun, we looked down some of them this morning. There was one that was about 585 pages long, which had photographs of all the seats that were inside of the aircraft, how mangled they were, etc. You had four files which collectively had about, I don't know, 1,200 pages, which was just the transcripts from the public hearings. And again, there were on the order of 1,000 documents of various types and photos too. And it's no joke. For fun, I said to myself, gee, I wonder if there are more words in here than the King James Bible. I looked it up. King James Bible has about 825,000 words. And if you go through and count these words, I'm sure you'll have at least that many. And this is not to disparage any religion, but there are a lot of opinions as to what the King James Bible is really saying and how it's saying it. There are a lot of opinions as to what the investigation was saying and how it was saying it. Not to mention all the conspiracy theorists who are out there who, to this day, claim that it wasn't the probable cause that was investigated thoroughly by Boeing, by NTSB, by independent laboratories, but it was a missile or it was some other unusual thing. And by the way, I did have a role in that investigation. I was at Boeing at the time, and my entire department, safety engineering, we were in support of the accident investigation. And we were scrambling just like everyone else in the initial part of that investigation, trying to figure out what happened. Because for a while it was a very deep mystery, which only through hard work and over time was the mystery, in my opinion, resolved satisfactorily.
Yeah, I believe the report. I was there. I spent countless hours up in looking at that wreckage. In fact, my special assistant, one of my people that worked for me, directly for me, spent 3 years on the ground up there with that airplane. He was my eyes and ears, so to speak. Let me know what was going on, what I should come up and take a look at. Back and forth multiple times. We'll get into all of that as we go forward.
And it will not be a
So.
single show either, because just so happens 2026 is the 30th anniversary of this event. And again, there's a lot to chew through there. And we're going to do our best to put some context behind what's going on. And by the way, for those of you who are old enough, you might remember Flight 800 was all over television, was all over CNN. It was 24/7, covered by newspapers day after day. in the world before viral things happened on the internet, this was viral in the traditional media sense. All the major newspapers, all the major television news channels, all the what little internet there was, plenty of stuff about this. So, and a little bit more beyond that, this is not the first time you had a traditional media viral event involving aviation. The first one I remember, and you might comment on this briefly, was in 1982, the Air Florida event, where it crashed into the Potomac River. And there was live rescues going on CNN, and the nation and presumably large parts of the world were riveted by this real-time event going on. So for those of you who think going viral just happened in the last few years with the internet, we've had at least 40 years as a society to get used to instant analysis, instant news, dramatic pictures being flashed all around the world. But let's go forward to 2002. This particular accident we're going to talk about today was none of that. Didn't have live coverage from the cable networks, didn't go viral on the internet, but it did have a unique place in aviation. For those of you who are looking at the video version of this show, I'm putting up a picture of the book UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record, which is a 2010 book written by Leslie Kane, who some of you might remember that name for her 2017 New York Times article, along with two of her journalistic colleagues, that talked about UAPs that were being investigated by the U.S. military. So in this book, she was talking about where official government records had details about what they used to call UFO events, but now they're calling UAP events. And the one we're talking about today, which happened on October 23rd, 2002 in Spanish Fort, Alabama, near Mobile, was one that was mentioned specifically in her book. And it also happens to be one specifically that you were a part of because you were on the board during that investigation, and you know details about this that goes beyond what was in the report and beyond what was mentioned by Leslie Kane. And let's just say that, in short, her book, she talked about this event and how in the preliminary report, there was an implication that there was some impact with an unknown object at 3,000 feet. But in the final report, that went away. Now, we talked about this off air. The preliminary report is something that comes out typically within 30 days. It usually has factual information, and it's not the final report. As facts come in, that report will be updated, and the final report might have things that don't end up in the preliminary report. And from your experience with this process, this isn't trying to hide anything. This is just how things are done. And part of that process is when the preliminary report is replaced by a final report, the final report is not going to be, for example, available on the NTSB website. Again, that's not a conspiracy theory. That's not an act of conspiracy. That's just how things are done at the NTSB. Now, John, from your perspective, have I said anything that was off base there?
No, no. So, you know, I took an interest in this after it was ongoing for a little bit. So I wasn't part of the on scene, but I was getting reports. The IIC happened to have his office very close to my office. And he was actually a friend that I've known for long before I went to the NTSB. And so we were talking about it every day. And I started to take an interest because of some of the things that I heard that we're going to get into in a few minutes. So I started to stay very much engaged in it as we move forward. We had a lot of help, or he had a lot of help in this. And that probably should take a little bit of explanation. All right, the size of the team. You know, general aviation accidents typically have one person doing the accident. And maybe sometimes two people out of the same office will do it. And oftentimes I get questions, well, we had a GA accident somewhere, sometime, and the NTSB showed up with seven or eight people to do the investigation. What were they thinking? Why was that? Well, you got one of the things that governs when we send groups of people out to do what most people would call a minor accident, a single airplane accident, maybe a Cessna 152 or 182, 72. But they'll show up with six, seven, eight people. Well, accident investigation is a perishable item. And if you don't have a lot of accidents going on, and it's usually I'm talking about major accidents, you'll have people from Washington launch to these smaller accidents to keep their skills up, to stay in the game, so to speak. And that's not uncommon. But some people try to read more into that than what really is there. It's just really trying to keep people engaged, keep their mind in the right place for doing investigations, because it is perishable. If you don't go out on an accident for a year, your skills are more than rusty.
Unfortunately, in this
Right.
case, there was a substantial amount of effort put into finding out what went on, including laboratory tests by more than one laboratory. But let's get back to the details here a little bit to give you a context of what went on. This was a Cessna Caravan 208, which was flying a cargo flight on behalf of one of the major cargo carriers. It was a single pilot operation by an airline transport pilot, several thousand hours of experience. And it was taking off at night from Mobile, close to the crash site, under instrument conditions. It was dark, there were several cloud layers, and the aircraft was between cloud layers at the time that shortly after takeoff, where there was a nearby aircraft, a DC-10. The cargo pilot was told about the DC-10. The cargo pilot apparently visually located the aircraft, and during the time that this was going on, where the pilot was communicating with air traffic control, looking for the aircraft, and confirming that he had seen the aircraft started to depart from controlled flight. It went from being at level flight about 3,000 feet to turning and descending at the same time. And over the course of the next few seconds, that rate of descent increased. There was evidence from the recording at air traffic control that the airspeed, or at least the sound of air over the cockpit, was increasing during this time. And it looked as though, looking at the final report and where the wreckage was, this aircraft entered into a very high angle, very high speed situation from which the pilot couldn't recover. And why that was, one can say that there are many things that cause that, including the fact that between the cloud layers at night, there's no visible horizon outside. And if you are distracted or your eyes are moving around in the cockpit at night in a situation like that, for example, trying to get your eyes on a passing aircraft, you could get into a situation where your inner ear gets confused. You think you're going nice and straight and level, but you're actually putting the aircraft into a situation that's not nice and straight and level. Again, I'm speculating here, but the sequence of events was something that was detailed by the NTSB. Takes off, climbs, levels off, looks for a passing DC-10, aircraft departs from control flight, and it crashes. And given the distance from the DC-10, there was no real possibility of an in-flight collision with this aircraft. And in fact, they checked the DC-10 for impact damage. There was none. And why do I mention that? As you can see from the pictures we're putting up, this is the aircraft that crashed in shallow water in Mobile Bay. And it was seriously broken up. And in some of these pictures, there are like these red paint-looking marks on them in various parts of the aircraft, not just one. And the report detailed that these red marks were seen primarily in the lower front part of the aircraft. And this is where the investigation comes in. You were intimately involved with that part of it, that investigation. How did that go?
After we pulled the airplane up, we'd already had all that data from ATC and everything that was available, including the communications. We had all that. We had nowhere to go. After we pulled out all together and looked at it, it had no conclusive indications of anything for us to pursue. When we brought the airplane up to continue the investigation, we had a lot of people looking at it, and those red streaks that you talk about had everybody concerned, and nobody could figure out what it was. The paint didn't match anything that we have any known aircraft paint type that was used. So that was another piece of baffling information. So as it progressed, every single process, investigating process that the NTSB has for each system came up empty. We couldn't find any indications of anything abnormal, except he fell out of the sky, and we have these red smear marks damage on the airplane. It was a little tough to determine whether that damage was caused by something that had red paint on it, or if it was impact with the water that caused some of the skin to buckle and the damage to the airplane. So it was really a baffle, because there was just no information there. It wasn't for the lack of trying, because we did put a lot of people on it. We spent a lot of time with it, but there was just nothing to follow up on. Everything was a dead end, but that we zeroed in pretty intently on that red paint and the stripes, because that was the only thing that was abnormal. If that indicated a mid-air collision, radar didn't show it. It was early for stealth. I don't know how much stealth was widely available at that time to the military. We just ran out of options. There was just no place to go. Hello, aviation enthusiasts, safety professionals, and curious minds. Welcome to Flight Safety Detectives. We are thrilled that you dropped by. Here, we dive deep into the world of aviation safety. From incident investigations and technical analysis to lessons learned and what they mean for safer skies. As a member of our channel, you get exclusive member-only perks, first access to new episodes, live stream discussions, and Q&A sessions. We are a community of fellow safety detectives who love aviation as much as you do. If you're passionate about aviation or just curious about how things work, we'd love to have you on board. Hit join, ring the bell to be notified, and jump into the discussions in the comments. Strap in, because together we're going to explore aviation safety like never before.
And certainly that's a possibility. There were military organizations and military bases within an hour or two flying time from Mobile that could have been a source of that. But we're talking 2002. For example, if it was a UAV, a drone of some kind, the drone technology going on 25 years ago was nothing like what we have now. You didn't have the fairly small, compact, extremely sophisticated drones by the thousands in the military. These would have been, many of them, converted regular aircraft that were just converted so that you could fly them without a pilot on board. And other drones, such as they were fairly large. And also, if something like that hit a Cessna Caravan, hard enough to cause damage to the caravan, and there was no real proof that there was in-flight impact damage to the caravan. Where's the proof? Was there pieces of some other aircraft in the water? Was there a crash aircraft anywhere in the vicinity? No. But you had these red stripes, these red markings all over the aircraft, several places. And again, we had shown you several pictures of that. And it's a mystery. If it was from an aircraft, then that paint would have been matched to some sort of paint used in a civilian or military aircraft. But correct me if I'm wrong, there was no definitive match to any paint being used in aviation.
Right. We tried every which way, the paint, the manufacturers, everybody.
And you might say to yourself, well, maybe this is a special paint, one time use only for the military. Possible. But this was not something that was an exotic material. In fact, some of the research that was done showed it was very close to material used, in fact, in the webbing and the cargo part of that aircraft, as well as similar to paint that could have been used elsewhere. But you have to say to yourself, if you're going to have a specialized paint for an aviation use, why make something so very close to what is already in use now? What would be the purpose? I can understand if it's stealth because to this day, the coatings used for the stealth fighter and the stealth bomber and whatever other stealth aircraft are out there is something that's not only proprietary, but it's a national security situation. To my knowledge, there was no national security interest in this crash, correct?
Correct. Now we probed the military and any of the contractors, military contractors in the area, because there is a Navy base there. So we were checking with all of them to see did they have anything flying that night? Did they have anything that was missing? Did they have anything come back damaged? And in fairness to the military, that's really not the area that they do all that kind of testing. That kind of testing is usually done in the Air Force. It's out in the West Coast, inland, like in Nevada or China. China Lake has the military testing, the Navy military testing. So that super secret stuff is all done out in the West Coast because it's too populated in the East Coast. Too many people with eyes and living on the beaches and whatever. There's not a lot of open space down there. So yeah, it's difficult to do secret testing in a highly populated area. So, but we did look at all of that. We dug deep into that because many of us, and I put myself in that same boat, were very concerned that was it a military secret operation that brought this airplane down.
Now,
Don't
one
forget, this was 2002, and the NTSB had already experienced all the negative claims on conspiracy for TWA 800. Were we covering up TWA 800? Which I can tell you, I don't didn't see that. Nobody worked on that with me, and so we were sensitive to that. So we were trying very much not to have another accident come up with something that was controversial as far as the probable cause and circumstances around the accident.
And this
But
was 13 months after 9/11 as well. So if there was even a hint of something unusual going on, either a military involvement or some unknown actor involvement, this would have had a different kind of intention entirely. And there was none of that intention. There were no threats. There were no military operational things going on in that area. There was nothing unusual in that part of the United States at that time that would call into question whether or not this is something other than a civil aviation accident.
we had the FBI in as part of it as well, so they were in looking to see if it was a crime, and they were on the they weren't part of the investigation, but they were there on the side, watching what we were doing, running their own investigation, and they had nothing to do.
And Leslie Kane pointed out in that passage in her book that the preliminary report implied there was a possibility of a mid-air collision, but it was not there in the final report. And typically, preliminary reports aren't available on the NTSB website. I was able to find it using a website called archive.org, where basically I went back in time and said, give me the page that talked about this event in late 2003. Or early 2003, what was it saying? And yes, the preliminary report was saying some things that were not in the final report, including
Silence.
not unusual. And one of the things that was not included in the final report was actually the results of the fact that there were specific tests going on. It was in the public docket, but not the final report. The public docket, by the way, is much, much, much bigger in this case, much, much bigger than the final report. And you have the full analyses that were done on the paint and other things that were done. So, in the fullness of time, a lot of the information that's either supporting the final conclusions or not supporting it are there for anyone to look at. Now, I'm going to call attention to a couple of passages in her book about this event. Not that I disagree with them. In fact, I agree with them. One passage was the final NTSB report indicated that the accident was caused by pilot disorientation. However, an independent investigation found numerous discrepancies with regard to both the FAA documentation and the investigation conducted by the NTSB. I think we mentioned this earlier, talking about Flight 800. If you look through the public docket and the final report long enough, you can probably find many things to support your theory, whatever that theory may be. But the preponderance of the evidence is what the final conclusion was in this report. And I had no problem with that. Nor do I have any problem with what she said here. And the last thing she said, if something struck this airplane, it certainly qualifies as a UAP until it is positively identified. There, I totally agree with her in that the working definition of unidentified anomalous phenomena that I've been working with my industry group at AIAA on a UAP aviation risk project includes something like this, possibly from a conventional aircraft, but with an unusual aspect of it that doesn't really fit with a conventional explanation. I don't know why those red streaks and red markings showed up all over various pieces of wreckage. It's certainly a head scratcher for me. It could have been from an outside source. It could have been from something internal to the aircraft. Was it something else altogether different? Only thing I can say is that part of this investigation is still unknown. So this, in my opinion, is still a UAP event.
It may very well be. Part of the problem identifying whether it was a collision or not was the damage incurred when the airplane hit the ground, the water, and the damage to the aluminum skin in the same areas where the red paint was. So you couldn't tell if that red paint was on there before the event. Was it red paint from a collision, or was the red paint there from a previous event? And was damaged in the impact with the ocean. We looked at every which way we could. Like I said, there was a bunch of people involved. If anybody came up with a thought or a concern, it was put on the table and worked on, because everybody was frustrated that we couldn't identify it. So we were taking every thought out of the air and making sure that we ran it to ground.
And this was
So
one of
it
these situations where you had this kind of impact, you had this kind of size of a crew working on this, because in part, there were no major investigations going on where they were called away to do that. So you had the luxury of resources. That doesn't happen all the time, especially with a, well, I hate to call this a lower level event. It was a fatal event, but it's not one involving a major aircraft. It was not one that was crashing in the middle of a major city. Was certainly not one that got any kind of major media attention at the time, even at the time the report was published. Yet it had a very high level of investigation.
Yep, timing, just because we needed to keep the people trained, big focus. Would they have had that anyway? When the IIC found the scrape marks, if he was a sole investigator, would he have gotten the help? I think he probably would have, but maybe not six or seven or eight people. But he would have gotten some help. Because we don't like We still say we, even though I've left there a long time ago. The NTSB doesn't like leaving unfinished business. And you could see that with the USAF 427 crash. 5 years they worked on that. Staff worked on that accident for 5 years before they finally ran it all to ground. So the NTSB doesn't like to leave things open-ended. And certainly that was part of the effort that went on here with this event, but there was just no place left to go. Just it was really baffling. I personally believe there was a collision, but we couldn't prove it. Could not prove it. Partially because of the water impact and the way water damages airplanes when they hit the ground, or even in the ground. But water is a little different. It's pretty solid when you come down, and it does a job on the aluminum skin and structure. So, despite the best effort of half a dozen people, they couldn't break through.
And that, I think, brings us to the second to last word for this one. An unusual second to last word. First thing I want to do is thank Leslie Kane. This was a great book that I'm quoting from. There was a lot of detailed reports from not just U.S. government, but governments around the world that 15 years ago, 16 years ago, were taking the UAP subject then called UFO subject, very seriously. And as I said before, I'm working with an AIAA committee right now where we're looking at this as an aviation safety and aviation risk issue. And one of the issues I'm going through is, are there things out there in the official records that have the look and feel of a UAP? This is one of those. And I don't disagree with Leslie Kane on many of the things she said in this book. In fact, I had the pleasure of interviewing her back in 2013, and I'll have a link to that interview where we talked about various issues that didn't really get taken seriously by the aviation community until the last few years. So I'm glad to see that these reports that are in the past are still there for us to look at again, like we did today, and see whether or not there is anything more we can understand about whatever this unknown thing was. So, you know, in the future, if there are things like this, I'm sure the quality of investigation will benefit from work like what Leslie has done, work that my committee is doing. And one hopes that, you know, we don't have many opportunities, just like I don't want to have many opportunities to investigate any accident. But the fewer unknowns there are, the better it is for aviation.
Yes. And for the last word, I will continue to say we need to pay attention to details. The general aviation accident rate is still high. Too many of them occurring. Too many young pilots having accidents. So please, if you're going to fly, do a good job of pre-planning your flight before you go to the airport. When you get to the airport, please compare them. Do it over again and compare them. Make sure they're the same. Make sure nothing has changed, like the weather. We still got some weather accidents occurring, which we shouldn't have. And I still see lousy pre-flights. Just saw one yesterday. Lousy pre-flight. Very brief. What I mean by lousy is somebody came out to the airplane, first flight of the day, very, very briefly walked around his airplane, climbed in, pulled the chocks, climbed in, and less than 10 minutes later was gone. So very, very brief first flight of the day, which is crazy. But you've got to pay attention to your airplane, and you've got to know what you're looking at. So please, if you're concerned that you might not have to, you might not be looking at all the right things, get a mechanic that looks at it, because mechanics look at airplanes different than pilots do. And let them show you what they look for in the airplane. Please, please put that head on a swivel when you take off. Mid-air collision just this week in New Jersey killed two people right at the airport. So please put your head on a swivel after you take off, and please fly safely.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetothetexas@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
For decades, Avemco Insurance Company has been an advocate for pilot safety by promoting and sponsoring continuous pilot training and education. One of their initiatives has been to reward pilots who actively participate in being more proficient with savings on their insurance premium through the Avemco Safety Rewards Program. Pilots save by earning new ratings, getting recurrent training, participating in the Fast Team Wing Program, and listening to podcasts like ours and other Avemco-related courses and training. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote or visit avemco.com/flightsafety. Don't forget to tell them the Flight Safety Detective sent you for an automatic 5% off.